changing your mind in the middle without the data changing is the biggest risk for an early stage startup. This is maybe an idea that I just use internally. I think companies own verbs. And for us, the verb is grow. Are we building the biggest thing? Is this aligned with what we care about?
Clay is probably the overnight success of the startup ecosystem in the last years.
From 0 to 30 million in ARR from 2022 to 2024.
When it comes to go-to-market and revenue operations, I think no tool has been discussed that often.
Clay automates data collection and enrichment, combining web scraping, APIs, and AI to streamline workflows and boost efficiency. And this is why today's guest is Kareem Amin, co-founder and CEO of Clay.
Because I've seen this before, the main thing you need to look for is, does anyone like it? You shouldn't focus on the people who don't care about it. You should be aware of why they don't care about it. But you should focus on... And that's what actually matters.
What many don't know is that you're building since 2017. I found an interview in which you stated that in early 2022, revenues were still close to zero. And then end of 2024, I found an article that estimates 30 million in ARR. What happened since 2017 that made you stick? And be honest, like, how often did you think about, hey, should we actually continue or should we quit?
Sounds like you want to dig into the juicy part.
There are many more founders out there struggling than experiencing hypergrowth. We're covering a little bit of the product-led growth motion that Clay is using. We are also talking about like the issues coming with hypergrowth, but the most part of the interview, we are discussing the frameworks that Kareem and his team used to find this one spark that then brought all the momentum. Therefore, without further ado, you're listening to the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and let's dive deep into the tactics on building Clay. Kareem, welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In general, many would say Clay is the overnight success throughout the last years. In the last months, when it comes to go-to-market and revenue operations, I think no tool has been named that often and has been discussed that often. But what many don't know is that you're building since 2017. And I found an interview in which you stated that in early 2022, revenues were still close to zero. And then end of 2024, or like the full year of 2024, I found an article that estimates like 30 million in ARR, which would definitely show what happened since 2022. But I would love to also understand what happened since 2017 that made you stick to building rather than saying, we're giving up, we're over it, we don't want that anymore. So take us back to the early beginnings of Clay, and then we'll uncover step by step a few of the stepping stones.
Yeah, of course. Sounds like you want to dig into the juicy parts. Yeah, so in 2017, I started the company with my really close friend, best friend, Nikolai. And we had gone to college together. We also like worked on a company before together. So we had been really just working together for most of our adult lives. And we had been feeling really excited about the idea of giving the power of programming to an order of magnitude more people, just making it more accessible. So it was really, I think, actually anticipating some of the stuff that's happening today with LLMs and just saying, like, if you can't kind of create malleable software or things that help you get your job done, you can't really capture a lot of the productivity gains that were happening in the 21st century if you can't tell a computer kind of what to do. And we were pretty much kind of exploring that space broadly and playing around with lots of different metaphors that hopefully people could understand for programming, right? So there was obviously like a workflow tool where you're like step one, step two, step three. And then there was other ideas that we had come up with, like what if you could connect to APIs and have a front end for them? So I think that ended up kind of being a product similar to Retool. But we had been exploring it around the same time. And we were also kind of thinking about spreadsheets and realizing that spreadsheets are the world's most popular programming environment, but they're not connected to all of the different APIs to pull data in and push data out. So they were kind of isolated. So it's almost like Google Sheets made it collaborative, but it didn't bring in data from various places on the web. You couldn't just click on a cell and say, bring, you know, the stock price of whatever. Or like, here's Google, like, what does it do? Right? Or like, give me a list of the people that work there. So that was kind of the beginnings of the idea for Clay.
So one of the things that you did early on and tested early on stuck with the vision till today and were the base layer, and what did you have to kick out of it?
Well, we had a lot of, I guess part of what, you know, the audience for your podcast might be earlier in their journey and thinking about kind of like different trade-offs. So we were pretty systematic about what decisions we had to make are. So one of them was, are we building this tool for software engineers who could be 10x better, or non-engineers? And that's something that we kind of kept going back and forth on in two ways. One is, what do we want to build? And then two is, what do we think is the biggest opportunity, right? And the reason we were thinking about the biggest opportunity is, like, the bigger the opportunity, the more chances you have to actually build more things and have more of an impact. So we were trying to calibrate those two things. And we decided actually that, you know, so in the beginning, I would say we were not making that choice clearly. We were kind of exploring. And we built within kind of like software developers, which we were looking at, we were like, okay, what are the categories here? Could we target indie hackers who are, you know, building small software products? And that could be a really interesting place to like speed them up there. If you have an idea, you can turn it into reality quickly. Generally, that concept of you have an idea and turn it into reality quickly has been something that has stuck from the beginning till now. And we were just deciding which customer should be able to do that. So with indie developers, the thought process that we came to was, okay, even if we help people here, they'll eventually want to move off to more customizable platforms. And so anybody that actually makes money will eventually leave, or else they'll be a small customer. And there's not enough of small customers for it to be a big enough business to sustain kind of like the ambition that we had. So we ended up deciding against that. And then there was, what if we targeted front-end developers who want to build internal tools? So we realized, okay, there's the category of all software, and then there's the category of internal software, which is usually something that you want to put together quickly. And maybe you're not the most technical person, but you need like a dashboard, or you need and not something that's just analytics, but something that actually takes action. And so we were pretty excited about that, because we're like, customer success could use this. There's a lot of like internal teams that need to build internal tools with software. What we ended up coming to, that one was a difficult choice, because we thought it would be a really good business and like a really big need, and it aligned with kind of our ambition. But we ended up also thinking that will, at the time, we thought there were kind of too many points of friction. In order to build it well, you need access to like your internal data. That's going to be some friction to go get that. So it's going to be sales-led, most likely. It's harder to build a PLG company if you need access to internal data as the first step. And then the second thing is, we were like, we can't probably make it easy enough for non-engineers. So we'll probably just speed up engineers. And we ended up mostly through this exploration deciding, hey, we want to help non-engineers, give people more access. So that led us away from those two categories of ideas to the spreadsheet as the metaphor that makes sense. And we ended up building a no-code builder app initially. So it was like a spreadsheet, which was kind of a database. We had like a workflow view where you could do workflows. And we even had a place where you could write functions to kind of manipulate the data. So, you know, for people who are familiar with Clay, this is quite a bit far away from where we are today, even though it actually is the same building blocks, but it might not be recognizable to people who aren't kind of familiar with the whole story.
So when did you find the first insights to move from developers to salespeople?
So it was actually my co-founder Nikolai who suggested this, and he kind of saw it from the beginning. He was like, oh, we could use this. I'll just walk you through our analysis, right? We're like, okay, we're working with spreadsheets, we're pulling in API. I built like a super simple version where you can pull in data from a couple of like different tools, and you could even like push data back. So, and when we saw it kind of like pop up in the cell, we both felt like, oh, this feels like magic, which ended up kind of being like the feeling that came across to others. But we were analyzing it and we're like, oh, if it's a spreadsheet, this is all super abstract, but I'm sharing it because I think it's helpful for other people whose brains work this way. But we're like, we could go to use financial data, numbers. That's what people do in spreadsheets. That's one thing that you could do. And there's companies like Equals that ended up doing that. Or you could go to list building, which is the other thing that people do in spreadsheets. And who's building lists? Well, it's salespeople, it's marketers, it's customer success, it's go-to-market teams. And so one of the things that he started doing was reaching out to people to talk about our product. And so he started doing prospecting and was like, hey, we should really kind of like set it up to do prospecting. And quickly we decided, okay, there's outbound and then there's inbound. And there was a huge kind of conversation around like where we should start. But that was kind of how we came to it. And we came to this pretty early, but we ended up spending a lot of time, like, I would say not deciding that this is our customer, or deciding and then kind of walking it back, which I think is a common kind of thing that happens when you're at an early stage startup. You kind of like need to figure out how to build conviction in this and why.
So you mean you left doors open widely and didn't narrow the product down enough?
Yes. So we both left it widely in the product and on our marketing page. So like even just like mentally, we kind of were thinking about salespeople, but if someone came to us with another use case, like we had a lot of like use cases on Clay early on, maybe it's a different type of data enrichment, or someone, there was an e-commerce store that was sending a lot of data through Clay and we would enrich it with a few pieces of information and send it back. So it was also not, both the customer wasn't clear and we were taking on too many use cases and trying to support them. And we had the typical thing where, you know, this customer, for example, would send us these bursts of data. And so our system would struggle to handle it. And it was, the question was, should we figure out how to scale this? Or is this not a core use case? Also, if you looked at our integrations, we had so many different types of integrations, right? They weren't all for data enrichment. So you could pull in product usage data, or you could pull in data from Stripe. It wasn't, and I think that's totally fine as you grow. You just need to kind of order it correctly and decrease the surface area so that you don't have as many bugs. At the time, we struggled with having a lot of bugs, and a big conversation we were having internally is, do we need to up our engineering skill, or is it because we have a very large surface area that there are bugs? Probably a mixture of both.
So your recommendation would be, especially in the early stages, you'd start with a very, very, very focused approach. And then you still have everything that you have in your head as a founder, how the product could evolve. Once you gain traction, you can still think about implementing things that are that you would build in a broader product because you're trying to leave or open doors. You can then think, hey, is this a use case that we can now implement once we have the tractions, once we know what our ICP, in this case, go-to-market and outbound salespeople need?
Right. I think that, like, to make it super concrete, I think that there are many, many different approaches, and you just have to know which approach you're on and be consistent and have that be aligned with what you're trying to achieve, right? So, like, let's fast forward to 2022, right? So, like, which elements we kept and which elements we dropped. So, first, you have to have conviction on what you're building and why. And that doesn't need to be upfront, it could be a back and forth process of, you know, you're seeing what customers want, what do you care about, and finding the mixture. So for us, we're a creative tool, right? So what creative means is that it's super flexible, it's open-ended. And so we kept that part. But then we narrowed it down for go-to-market teams to grow their business, right? So our mission is to help the companies grow by turning any idea that they have into reality. So we kept that part. So clay is still a, you know, I compare it to like a guitar versus a microwave, right? If you go to a microwave, it has a single use case or a couple of use cases. You're going to heat your food, maybe auto defrost, you press a button, it works. With a guitar, you have 6 strings and 12 frets and you can play anything. You can spend your whole life figuring this out. And there's a feeling of mastery that comes with that. So we're the same way that Figma is for designers, right? Or an IDE, like Cursor is for developers. Clay is kind of the tool for expression for go-to-market teams. And so that was really important. And what that the implications of that are that we create these building blocks in Clay, and that's why the company is called Clay, that you can mix and match together to implement your idea. So we needed to be super clear about what are the building blocks, right? What are the primitives in the product? And so that stayed open-ended, right? Like there's the table, there's integrations, there's ways to connect these integrations together. And then after that, what we did was actually take our positioning and marketing and narrow that. So the product, we removed the workflow product and the function product. We kept the table as the table enrichment. And we decided our first kind of product is if you are struggling with having really great data enrichment, we aggregate every data provider and we show it to you in a table so you can build a list of companies and people and you can see all of the, you can mix and match how you do the data enrichment and then you can send it to an outreach tool or a CRM, right? And so that's like a very clear problem and a very clear proposition using the same things that we built, but we just articulated the problem differently. And it still ended up, people felt like they were programming because they were playing around with different data enrichments and how to set it up. But it was a very narrow use case. And then we moved our positioning and our go-to-market to be just about that. So I think actually we narrowed down our go-to-market and kept the product flexible. So we only simplified a few things in the product, like removed integrations that don't make sense anymore, but kept it open-ended. And I think that's one strategy if you want to build a creative tool.
Before we talk about like what made the product then so sticky and so that people at some point, like from all the like differentiation to the years before, thought, hey, that's what I need, let's quickly talk about the conversations you had with your co-founders. Because what we currently walk through are years of, hey, we see some signs that things are working, but it's not picking up that much as we want. What are we doing? Is it enough to build further? Do we have to pivot? What? So constantly you have to reiterate as a team. You have to have very hard conversations.
Yeah.
So what is your advice for teams currently building that don't see the uptick yet on truthful and hard co-founder conversations?
I mean, I think you have to have really high bandwidth between the co-founders to be able to talk about this. And my advice is, what's tricky in these types of conversations is kind of going in loops or revisiting the same subjects over and over again when nothing has changed. So I think what's helpful is to set a time where you're discussing what is it that we're building. Because I think that when you're in a startup, every kind of couple of days, you feel differently. So sometimes you feel, I mean, people are quite familiar with this. Sometimes you feel like things are going well, our idea is going to work, it all makes sense. And then other times it feels like this is a dead end or it's not as big of an idea as you thought. And interestingly, a lot of the things that we thought early on ended up happening in Clay. And it's kind of funny to be like, oh, we thought about this like 4 years ago and now it's finally like coming to fruition. But it also just really depends on timing and the amount of momentum that you have in the market. So there are many things that we did that, I'll give you a simple example, right? Like we had to decide, is the product going to be super easy? You press one button and, you know, it builds a list and you kind of like can get on with it. Or are we going to give you maximum power, right? And everybody thought it should be super easy, right? If you're selling to salespeople or marketers, it needs to, they're busy. It needs to kind of be a few clicks and get stuff done. We actually ended up going the opposite direction right, where it's super flexible and super powerful, and we give it to kind of the people who are ready to push the boundaries on how to do these tactics. And that's both a differentiation, and it builds, it helps them figure out how to grow in how to do growth. And it ended up being actually what's necessary, because a lot of things here, the last 20% are super finicky, and if you don't do it right, it doesn't work, right? So that kind of decision, you, when you're chatting with your, let's say, your team about it, you just have to be really clear about which one of these are you going to try first, what you believe about it, and then why do you believe that's different? We ended up seeing that that ended up working. The other version could have also worked, by the way. You know, there are products that are super simple and, or maybe not even the word simple, but they're super targeted on one use case and it works. You just need to know which one you're doing and why you believe that's the biggest one. So once you decide that, my suggestion is you commit to a time frame where you're going to test it out and really give it a chance. And do not change your mind in the middle. I actually think changing your mind in the middle without the data changing is the biggest risk for an early stage startup. And even right now, when we, you know, when I work with our engineering teams, they might ship a feature and be really depressed that no one's using it. But because I've seen this before, I would say the main thing you need to look for is, does anyone like it? Right? So you might ship something, maybe 10 people start using it. And so we need to focus on those 10 people. So not, you shouldn't focus on the people who don't care about it. You should be aware of why they don't care about it. But you should focus on, if does anyone like it? If zero people like it, you should try something else. If there's a couple of people that like it, you should focus in on them and say, why do you like it? What is actually useful here for you? Is it the same thing that we believed it is, or maybe something else? And then what else do you want? And then build momentum with them. And very soon, so we've had features that we've launched, looks like a flop, right? But then we hone in on the people who thought it was interesting or who used it. We improve it really quickly. We only work with those people. And then suddenly it becomes more useful to a broader set of people.
I know you're answering it depends. So therefore, I won't ask if like one person can be enough to find the momentum that you're looking for. I'd rather ask, how are you approaching the launch of new features now? Are you giving them out and just like unlocking them and saying, hey, let's just see who clicks on that? Or are you saying, hey, statistically, we need like a subset of, like when you say you have north than 100,000 users, are you only rolling it out to 1,000 and see how many of these are using them? How are you approaching that today? And how are you deciding that?
Yeah, I'll answer your first question as well. I think that I would say one person is not enough. You should be talking to more than a couple of people so that you have some repeatability. And I think if there was one person who was interested in it and I've shown it to 20 people, I would be curious what's unique about that person. So I would say anybody that's interested is gives you something worthwhile. But by interested, I mean, if you've built it, they're using it. Not they say they like it, they're actually using it. If it's just someone who says they're curious about it, you need to figure out why they're curious and are there more people who are curious for the same reason. I think the trick early on is you might, you should be very honest with yourself if they like it for the same reason or if it's multiple different reasons and you're trying to make it work. That's the hard part about building things is holding the honesty of like, wow, five people like this, but for completely different reasons, and still holding the optimism of like, we will figure it out. Even though I know that this isn't actually working right now, we'll figure it out. So you still need to be honest with yourself that this isn't quite it and have the optimism that we'll figure it out. Hopefully that's helpful. I think it is balancing those two kind of ways of looking at the truth, but you definitely need to see the truth. If you're lying to yourself and saying, oh, they are saying the same thing or everybody's interested in this feature, then and you didn't really hear the customers, then it's not going to work. So don't lie to yourself to have optimism. You can look at yourself failing and still be like, we're going to get it. And then for the second question, how do we launch things today? I think there are two types of features. We have this line internally that we call make it work, then make it great, right? And so it depends on what type of feature it is. So if it's a make it work feature, that means that either some customer, we have a lot of, you know, our Slack channel has 20,000 people. So we have a lot of feedback. We have a lot of customers using it. So we get a lot of information about what people need. And if you are just unlocking something for a customer, then we unlock it and we put it out. And unlike, you know, if you're building SpaceX, you can't have a mistake. Otherwise, the thing blows up, right? Whereas with go-to-market experimentation, creative software, we can launch things. If it doesn't work, there's no problem, right? We can fix it quickly. So we tend to launch things that customers ask for directly to customers and then iterate quickly. If it's a make it great feature, then either that's already something that we have and we're trying to streamline it or take it to the next level. And in that case, we take our time designing it, building it, and we roll it out to a small, so we have like an experimentation system set up. We roll it out to 10, 50%, 25, 50%, and to 100. Anything that has a lot of impact on customers, we roll out slowly or progressively.
That makes a lot of sense. So still not over the lower end of the journey, like the starting point. How often, and be honest as you can, like how often did you think about, hey, should we actually continue or should we quit and do something completely new, or should I go back to a product lead or VP product or anything?
All the time. But I think that, I don't think that like in the first couple of years, like let's say 3 years, that ever occurred to me. I think the thought that came was are we, the thoughts that had, like, I think this is really specific to the co-founding team, right? Like, what is your loop, you know? And you, I think with different configurations of people, it turns to different things. Like, for us, it was very much like, are we building the biggest thing? And then, is this aligned with what we care about? Those were kind of our questions that kept coming up. I think we really believed that we were going to build something meaningful and something good because we believed in ourselves. And also because we wanted to, like we really felt that we had the capability and the desire to do it. But it was more like, are we building a thing? Like, is this still aligned with our vision of giving the power of programming or not? Right. And does that matter? So that kind of came up a lot. And then the other one. So, you know, as soon as we started thinking about go to market, we're like, well, we're not sales or marketers. So why should we be in this space, right? Like, what do we know about it that other people don't? So it was partially convincing ourselves that what we had here was something valuable to add. And eventually we came to that because we're like, oh, we played around with existing tools. We tried to do prospecting and we're like, this is not how we would have designed it, right? So we do have an insight here. And then we eventually needed to come to care about it by saying, oh, it is about giving this creative ability to a whole group of people that have all of these ideas of how to grow the company but can't execute it, right? So once those two things aligned, it became easier to build. And then there's the second part is like, is this the biggest idea that we could do? And I think I've talked about this before, but for me, this was a personal journey of coming to a place where I didn't need to do that. And so I don't think about that a lot. I think it's actually a red herring and potential trap. I think you need to kind of keep an like eye out for like what is the biggest thing if that's what you care about. But if you explicitly try to build the biggest thing, I think you will fall into a lot of kind of like traps along the way because it starts being about you rather than about how you're helping other people. And a business is really about helping other people. So I had to kind of come to a place where I'm like, it doesn't really matter if we're building the biggest thing or not. Like we're building a creative tool to help go-to-market people turn their ideas into reality. And that's what we care about, right? And I can, because you can always, one of the other things is you need to look at yourself as a team and know some people are so focused on the details and they don't have a big picture. Whereas we actually had like a very big picture. So we knew that we can always grow the pie, but we didn't have kind of like, okay, what are we doing next? So I knew that what we needed to do was to focus. Some other people need to broaden, right? Again, that's why the advice needs to actually be specific to what is your current... Yeah, where what do you need in the specific moment? And what we needed is to not pay attention to what is the biggest market or analysis around that. Because I knew that you could always add something that's adjacent. This is a huge space. And this is something, a way to figure out if something is big or not, instead of doing market analysis, which is possible, but is not my favorite tool, is to really think about like, what is something fundamental that doesn't change, right? If you're in capitalism, businesses have to grow and they have to figure out ways to grow. They're trying out all these different ideas of how to grow their company. They need to be able to try out these ideas quickly and see which ones work and which ones don't. And if we are the tool to help them do that, that's obviously going to be a huge lift, right? And you will be able to capture a lot of value if you did that and provide a lot of value. So we knew it was going to be big. So then you have to kind of drop the need for it to be big immediately or quickly. And just focus on building momentum. And I think that's actually the main thing in a company. Everybody talks about it, but the practical reality of building momentum, which means find some customers that are similar and then figure out which groups they're in, how to find more like them, make sure that the messaging is the same. And then once you get these customers, you should be able to get more engineers or you can build your team around this because you have a clear need. And by the way, teams work much more efficiently when they can see that they're serving someone. If you're building a team and you're just pitching them on keep building and then eventually you'll get customers, at some point they run out of steam. But if they can hear the customer, and that's what we did in our Slack channel, ask for something, then you'll find your engineers immediately delivering because they can see their impact. And then you can use that to raise money if that's what you want to do. And then keep the loop going. And that's actually what leads you to something big.
Take me back to the moment when you and the team for the first time had the feeling like, whoa, we now have the momentum that we were looking for years.
So when we launched the product on Product Hunt in February 2022, it was kind of a fun story because we were at our office and we were preparing for it. And, I think you have to launch it as like 12 a.m. PT. And so we're like, well, should we stay up for it? And we're like, well, we'll probably go home and do it from home. But we ended up needing to do so many last minute things that we stayed up till like 3 a.m. that day at the office. And we started seeing kind of like the votes come in. And we ended up being, we went to sleep from like 3 a.m. to 6 and then got back up and kept going. And it was fun because I remember emailing everybody that I've ever met in my life and being like, please do this, help support it. And we ended up being number one for the day and the week and the month, I think. Or maybe the day and the week and second for the month. But what was great is that we saw kind of like this uptick of people understanding what to do in the product and it starting to resonate with people. It was super early on. And we did have some revenue at the time, but it wasn't that much. And within 2 months from then, there were a couple of people who had left the team at that point. And we started kind of building up the team again. And I think it was probably in June 2022 that we started seeing consistent growth month over month, and it stayed in double digits the whole time until now.
I think I read that you 10x'd 2 years after another, so from 22 to 23, from 23 to 24, which definitely shows the amount of uptick and the amount of momentum that you got. What would you say were the building blocks for the momentum to consistently stay and not like, because there are so many companies that I know that have like this Product Hunt moment or others that are, let's say, creating this buzz as a one-time, as a one-off, and then it's flattening and then growth is flattening or not staying at all. So you must have had some building blocks that are tailored or at least helping to keep the momentum.
Totally, yeah. I mean, so, just to give you a sense of how like Clayworks, there's a PLG motion, which has been primarily how we've been growing. So PLG, you find the product, you sign up and you start using it and you pay us. And we just layered on what we call a sales assist motion, which is some of the PLG customers, we upgrade them to annual if they're using the product in particular ways that make sense for that. And then we have a sales-led motion, which we've introduced recently. So, you know, on the longer term, we're adding these different motions together, and we just have a partner motion now where we have a lot of the agencies and other kind of partners that help, that we co-sell with. So, you know, I think for long-term growth, you need to layer on multiple go-to-market motions. Initially, though, at the time that we did the Product Hunt launch, we had my co-founder Varun was just joining us. And at the time, he was kind of joining in a head of ops role. And he played a very big part in setting up our go-to-market motion. Well, he was responsible for the go-to-market motion, but he played a really big part in kicking that into gear. And what he did was pretty amazing. So he would sit almost like a PM. He would sit with our customers to do an onboarding call. And we had one dedicated engineer working with him who was a customer engineer. And basically, Varun would sit in these back-to-back calls all day, every day, for 30 minutes, onboarding customers. So they would come with a problem. And initially, it took us 3 calls to get them set up on Clay. And our metric was like, let's drive this down to 1 call. So let's make product improvements. So he would get on these calls, send me all the feedback. Me and the engineer would work on prioritizing these and getting them right, or figuring out like what is the actual solution. And we would do them immediately. Sometimes while the person was on the call, we would fix the issue. And then we got it down to 1 call. When we got it down to 1 call, we decided to do something called a reverse demo. So when you come, we don't demo the product. You come to us with a problem, and then we walk you through how to set it up in Clay. And what that did was we both got feedback from you because we could watch what you're doing. And at the same time, we were teaching you how to use the product so you could use it yourself. And then we eventually said, okay, let's drive it down to 0 calls. So in order to do that, we had to build documentation, fix all the issues with the product that we know about, and then make sure that we only take calls if it's something new or unique that we haven't seen before. So that was the initial path. At the same time, we found out that, and this was kind of interesting because a lot of agencies, B2B agencies, help with growth. And they're very sophisticated, actually. So they're more sophisticated often than some of the bigger companies because they're experimenting with the latest techniques for growth. And we had a bunch of them using Clay or experimenting with Clay. But initially, we weren't focused on them because we thought, is this the right market for us? Are they the right customer? You know, they're not in companies that are super well known, so people won't know kind of like that we have this traction. But as we started talking to them, we realized they actually have the most need. They're working with multiple companies that we would love to work with. So they're a great channel partner for us. And at the same time, their feedback was extremely effective and helpful. And so we found out that they often have these WhatsApp groups where they're sharing ideas. And we talked to a few of them, became really friendly. Varun kind of got to know a couple of them personally that became personal friends. And we basically just joined their WhatsApp groups and would help them figure out what they need to do and also fix any of the issues as quickly as possible. And that became our initial distribution channel and the initial kind of like feedback loop. So once that happened, we realized that they need customers. And so they would post on LinkedIn saying, hey, here's this cool play that we have for go-to-market, and we're using Clay to do it, right? And that became an engine of telling other people about Clay.
When I sum this up, you have, by now, you have 20,000 people in Slack channel. You early on used, for example, the so-called Clayagencies that you build up and helped and worked together with building the product. And so when I summarize this or put this together, it's definitely a community play because you were working close with people that then also share it on, for example, LinkedIn, that they are working with Clay and use that as a word of mouth motion. And so what would you say? Because I know a lot of B2B founders who would say it's not possible to build a B2B community at the moment, not for my product. So how and why did it work to build a community motion, and what was making it successful?
Yeah, I think that's, again, why you need to align your go-to-market motion with the type of product that you're building and where you're trying to achieve. So in our case, it's a creative tool, right? So creative means you have a bunch of primitives, high flexibility, and you're trying to turn any idea that you have for growing your company into reality. And so the community here makes sense, because when we set up our Slack group, we initially set it up as a customer support public forum. And that was a risky idea because everybody could see people's complaints, right? But it ended up being super helpful because people would post about something, someone else might respond to it, or we would respond to it, and people could see the speed at which we were responding, which built momentum. But we were already tapping into the fact that people were building communities about this. The communities were these WhatsApp groups where they were sharing these tips and tricks. And so we just kind of went into these communities and aggregated them into the same place. So we realized, okay, you're already doing this stuff in WhatsApp groups, and we are doing it publicly in our Slack channel so you could see all the different tactics. And because our product was super, super open-ended, it actually made sense to, and it ended up always, there's like a latest tactic, or there's like a way to do something that's a little bit more complex. You could get help from others, and then the others would get credit and cachet for helping you, whether it's personal or like broadly, people start to get known, to be like, oh, this is the person you ask about things. And then they would get hired, right? So, you know, one of the early people that we worked with was Eric Novoselsky. And part of what he was doing was he was sharing his tactics and techniques, because then he wanted to help people, but two, he would get well known as the person who knows the most about this. And then people would hire his agency.
I think that's super interesting, because when I think and spin this further, like everyone coming to me saying, hey, it's not possible for me, I would say, think about the ICP that you have. And it doesn't always have to be a Slack community, but building community can be hosting a dinner for the CFOs or the head of FP&A or the different kind of ICPs you have, and bring them together at some certain points. Spark conversations, probably create content around that. Of course, it feels more obvious in quotation marks to do that for go to market, but there are so many different needs out there that if you know very specifically, and that's what we discussed in the first half of this podcast, is like saying no to a lot of things to find the thing that you want to commit to. If you know what you commit to, it's easier to also think, hey, these are the people that we want and need to bring together to then spark the conversation and become more of a household brand in that space. Is that something that starts from one day to another? Definitely not.
Yeah. And you want to know, like for us, we our kind of like, this is maybe an idea that I just use internally. I think companies own verbs. Right. So maybe Google owns search or organize, right? Uber owns to move. And if you use that kind of concept, you could say, okay, Uber, you know, there's a person moves another person to another place. But then you can, instead of move a person, move a package, right? Instead of a person moving it, it could be autonomous. So you can come up with all these different ideas around the verb. And for us, the verb is grow, right? And we think about it as not just grow, like help grow companies, but help grow people. So sometimes the thing that's blocking the company's growth is personal growth. And so that's what we focus on in our community. We're trying to help people grow authentically, right? So both grow in their job or just grow as human beings. And so if you're setting up kind of an event and it's about personal growth, and people then care about your company and your product because they know a lot of people that use Clay are getting promoted because of the impact that they're having. And that's what actually matters. And that's what matters to us. And that's what matters to them.
There are so many ways to continue. But the one question that I have in mind for a while already is, what is the major shift that we are currently experiencing in the whole world of go-to-market that Clay is definitely on the one hand driving and on the other hand riding the wave at the same time.
Yeah, I'll just steal your comment right now. There's many ways to answer this. I think we are riding a wave of, you can think of it as like malleable software or just-in-time software with LLMs, right? You can build software faster now and custom-made software, and that's something that we believed in early on, but now is made even more realizable. And so I think what Clay does is it allows you to express like an idea really quickly into software. And it is much, much, much more customizable, and it's much easier to customize this. And I think in the go-to-market space, the more it's all about being unique and getting people's attention. And the way to do that is to target the right people at the right time and say the right thing. That's always been the case. But the techniques to do that are becoming increasingly more complex because you have a lot of data that's available, and Clay allows you to work with that quickly and easily, right? So another way to say this and to look at the market is there's copilots and things that help, let's say, sellers or marketers or frontline people do their job more efficiently. So there's tools doing that. Then there's the opposite end of that. There's like all these tools that call themselves digital workers and are trying to replace the person fully and just say, okay, well, AI will do the whole thing. And then I think we're riding a wave where we're saying there's a third way, which is you move the jobs to be done to a more technical person, like a GTM engineer or a RevOps person, and they can enable the frontline people by trying out all of these creative ideas really quickly using AI. And I think we're riding the wave of this emergence of this more, or it's almost like a reformulation of this more technical person being very central because they can use tools like Clay and AI to enable a whole team and both decrease the number of people that are needed to do something and do more things and upskill. So now if you're an SDR, you can either spend all of your time talking to customers or you can upskill yourself and become one of these GTM engineers.
How will this change the setup of GTM teams?
I think that you will find that that you will consolidate more of the tasks into one person. So instead of having maybe an SDR, an AE, and the sales engineer, we've kind of combined all of those roles into GTME, right? So I think you upskill people and then they're able to do a couple of different tasks, which I think is both more interesting and more powerful, right? And I think the way that the teams are structured would be that there's always going to be, you can look across all of go-to-market, so it's less siloed, sales, marketing, customer success. You should be looking at all of your efforts across these as GTM. And then I think there's a GTM ops team, almost like a systems team that's looking at, hey, do we have all the data from all the different places, third-party data and first-party data to make the best go-to-market kind of campaigns? And then that team is enabling the go-to-market team to implement their ideas, and the go-to-market team is passing ideas back to the ops team, who then implements them and tells them if it worked or not. So I think you really need this GTM ops and systems team.
How are you building your own go-to-market team then?
It's very much exactly how I described this. So we have go-to-market engineers who are playing the role of salesperson and sales engineer. And then we have a go-to-market ops team that is basically taking the best tactics and using and implementing them really quickly in Clay. And what's that? The cool thing that that's allowed us to do is we almost don't have anybody entering any information into CRMs manually. Everything is automated. But also the team is able to be way more creative because they're being supported by all of the ops kind of roles in automating a lot of like, how do you prepare for a meeting? Who have we reached out to? Getting the information from our own internal systems about who this customer is really, really quickly, as well as our outreach. We're sending a lot more outreach through Clay and having it be very, very accurate to the person's needs.
So knowing that Clay is definitely a substantial part of your own go-to-market, but probably not the only one because Clay is not delivering every solution to every problem, what are the tools that you are the most excited about when we look at the go-to-market stack. And we don't have to talk about like all tools. I think there is no time for that. But like at least like one, two more that you think could deliver a lot of value to founders listening.
Yeah. So I think, you know, just to add to your first comment, we do use Clay internally for most things. And then there are a bunch of features that we haven't released that we build internally first. So we build, you know, some of the things to power ourselves. And once they work, we ship them. So we tend to kind of build versus buy, obviously, for go-to-market tools. The things that I'm excited about are, well, one of our customers, Intercom, their tool, Finn, has been very, very helpful on the customer success side, helping us basically answer a lot of like questions that our support team would know how to answer quickly, but would be very repetitive. And so that they can focus on the kind of like more complex questions that are interesting. And then the second thing is that it's a really good place for the product team to hear what are the problems, right? Like what are the constant questions and things that keep coming up? And for me as a CEO to be able to kind of quickly dig into categories and then see the actual things people are saying has been super helpful.
Super interesting. I'll link to Finn in the show notes as well as to Clay, obviously, but still just adding that to it. When we quickly have to talk about hypergrowth. Like, to be honest, it's definitely one of the things that everyone would describe Clay as a company and organization with. What would you say, even when some founders that are in the more kind of in the situation that you were for 5 years and could describe it as a more of a luxury problem to have like the hyper growth and all the problems that come with it, what would you say is the hardest part about hyper growth and scaling?
I think the hardest thing is the organizational design and kind of figuring out how to like revisit that. What is the optimum kind of times where you change the structure of the org versus keep it as is, even if some things are not quite aligned, right? Because as the team grows, its internal comms becomes super important, right? So how do you communicate the vision and the strategy and why the team is organized in this particular way for the moment? And because things are changing so quickly, you have to, the way to do that, I think, is to make sure that you have people who are super flexible and emotionally mature, right? So, you know, we went from 25 to 100 people in 1 year, and then, you know, we went from like 100 to probably 135 from the beginning of the year. So the trick to doing that is to make sure that your people talk about culture a lot, but how do you make that more concrete? Right. So we've built an operating principles document like many other companies, but just being super clear about what your operating principles are so that the company needs to have a sense of how it's operating and not be whiplashed. So if you're a super flexible company, don't suddenly turn into a, you know, super disciplined company or a very rule-abiding company. If you do that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing that confuses people as you're growing. You need to have some consistency because there's already so much change. You need to decide what are the things that stay the same and which things are flexible and change. Maybe that's too vague for people to understand, but you know, I'll give a quick example, right? Like we are okay, for example, having a reporting structure that doesn't reflect kind of the priorities right now, as long as everybody on the team understands what they're doing, right? That doesn't bother us. Just because moving the reporting structure, you know, moving one team from reporting to one manager to another one creates, even if in the most kind of flexible people, a little bit of slowdown. You have to get, you know, to know this new manager. What do they need? How often are they meeting? So if things are working, keep them working, right? Only change things once you get to a stage where there's either like a pause or there's a big reason to change the team. So sometimes we've had people, you know, common advice is you should only have, you know, 5 to 8 people reporting to you, right? Whereas until now, the whole engineering team still reports to me. We have a few engineering managers. So we have 4 engineering managers And there's 40 people in the engineering org, and we don't have a head of eng. I'm the head of eng, right? The product team, we have 4 people. They all report to me. We have, you know, the finance team is reporting to me. The people and brand team are reporting to me. So that's a huge number of people reporting to me. And in actual reality, I'm obviously not doing, and I don't do any one-on-ones, right? It's just, if you have an issue, message me and we'll deal with it immediately, right? And if you need some time, just book it on my calendar. Now, obviously, that will change as we continue to grow, but we haven't needed to change that. And we haven't needed to add a layer of management that you need to work through, because that does make things more complicated. So I would say keep things going with as direct an impact as you, direct connections to the individual contributors as you can for as long as you can, because then you have a pulse on what's happening. And then you add the layer of management when you need to. And even then, you don't need to make it super formal unless that's kind of how you want to run the company. But that's one way in which we've been able to scale without losing touch with kind of like what's happening or dealing with problems immediately.
Super interesting. And I'd love to double click on your calendar and time management. Because when you say, hey, I have so many direct reports, I don't do 101s. Of course, sometimes there are things like podcast recordings like this one. But besides that, when you say, hey, message me and we'll deal with it immediately meaning as soon as you see the message, this sounds like you have a very flexible calendar and try to minimize meetings and try to be like, when we look at Paul Graham's makers versus manager schedule, I'd suggest you have a maker schedule, trying to block as much time as freely as possible so that you can focus on the things that you want to. As in my opinion, most founders quickly in scaling companies tend towards the manager schedule.
Yeah. Well, I think that, so one of the harder parts for me was kind of letting go of I wrote a lot of the initial code and, you know, built a bunch of the product. So like letting go of doing that on a daily basis. And I think just to be clear, I think you should figure out the management style that works for you very specifically. And I think the thing that's underlying that is that you need to stay in touch with the company's pulse. And the best way I think to do that is to stay in touch with the ICs and what is actually happening. And so I have like a couple of tactics to do that instead of one-on-ones, right? I keep my calendar reasonably open. And so you could either Slack me if there's an issue, right? Or just book 15 minutes and we can deal with it then. And sometimes you might be like sending me, so we call it FYI culture. So you're just like, FYI, this is happening. I'll read it. Keep everything kind of like in the open and Slack channels. And that way, even if I don't do it during the day, I might read it at another point, right? If it's not urgent, I'll still kind of get to knowing what's happening. So I think I'd say that this is a more reactive structure, right? But it works really well. If you have people who are, if your setup is like distributed decision making, which is what we have, try to empower the people who are working on things to make the decision, and then they can FYI me if they're blocked on something or if something's not clear. So if I see something is not clear across many people, then I might set up a meeting to bring everybody together and figure out, okay, is the vision not clear? Is the strategy not clear? So that's the internal comms part. Often it's just a people thing, right? So like this person doesn't want to do this thing, or this person disagrees with this path, or this person is, you know, it could be an interpersonal conflict, right? Like, I don't like the way this person's talking to me about X thing. And so you're constantly kind of smoothing out these issues or coaching the managers to do it for next time. But I think it's really important to have your space as a founder free to make sure that you're aware of all of these issues and actually intervening and coaching where needed and bringing, or realizing, hey, we need more principles or some things are not clear. We need to clear them up. The other thing is that we have a weekly all hands where we kind of like bring up one kind of like department that talks about what they're working on. as well as I usually give actually, it's almost like, this is a fancy way of calling it, but like a Dharma talk. Like at the beginning of every all hands, it's like, how do we operate at Clay and why? And how does this really matter? I think probably 50% of people like it and 50% of people don't care. But I think it's a helpful way of helping them at least know what's on my mind. And then every week we have a open Q&A session. So like anyone in the company can come and ask a question, and it's well attended because, you know, we discuss various things that are happening in the company very transparently.
I think that's very interesting. One thing that I want to cover before we need to end up this podcast is the people. And I want to understand, what were you looking for in the earliest team members that you hired versus what are you looking for in approaching hiring today? What are commonalities? What changed due to the growth that you're having? Just to for other founders to get an understanding what you value in the people that work for Clay.
Yeah, I think that the top things that we value is, did we learn something from you during our interaction? And it can be anything, right? Did I learn, if you're an engineer, did I learn something from you about how you would approach like a particular problem? If you're a product person, did you give me a new way of looking at this? If you're a go-to-market person, did you come up, you know, our interview for Clay, for go-to-market engineers is do something interesting with Clay, right? So it's almost set up to learn something from you. So I think that's our top thing. Did we learn something from you? And then number two, we call it a quiet ego, right? So are you able to navigate a conversation in a way where we feel like you're both teaching us something and maybe receiving some feedback or changing your mind about something? Or, you know, the high bandwidth communication, I think, requires a low ego, and we really value that. So if we're having to watch every word that we're saying to make sure that things are okay, then we're just slowing down our communication throughput. And then I think for early, so, you know, these two things imply a number of things, right? They imply you're smart. They imply that you're have like humility. They imply that you're flexible, right? A lot of things that we care about at Clay. But I think those two things kind of stand out and are maybe unique. And then the other thing is, in early like team building, I think that you do want T-shaped people. I find that like everybody talks about everybody has an A team and the best people in the world, etc. But if you want actually helpful advice, right, like why are the best people in the world joining you? They probably aren't, right? Unless you're a second time founder or you've done something before or you already have some kind of network where you're connected to the best people in your field, why would someone join you initially? They probably aren't. So I think you're kidding yourself if you think you have the best person in X or Y. You want to actually hire people who are unique. I find that like our early team is the best at like one or two things. There are occasionally you meet someone who is actually truly the best in the world for a number of things and is well-rounded, and they'll probably join you because of the mission and the culture, right? But in most other cases, you're finding someone who spikes in one area and maybe doesn't spike in another area. And that's why they don't fit into traditional, like larger companies. Those are the unique people that you want on your team, right? Like someone who, you know, one of our early engineers was really, really fast, incredibly fast. So he would sometimes have more bugs than we would like today, but he was incredibly fast at shipping features. And that speed was a huge competitive advantage. Probably the fastest engineer I've ever worked with, right? But definitely not the most comprehensive engineer. And then we had another engineer who doesn't ship any bugs, like very, very careful, but requires a lot of more detail. So there's kind of like everything has like two-sided edge to it. And so it's almost like a sports team. You're kind of balancing the team out. You don't want everybody to have the same role. So we kind of have someone who's super fast and then someone who doesn't ship bugs. And if you manage that correctly, you end up having the best of both worlds.
And then one thing that I can't let you go without, to back to a topic that we discussed briefly only, sadly, but too many things to talk about. What would you say is the hardest part about building a product-led growth / PLG motion? So that quick explanation again for everyone who probably hears this the first time. This means I can go to the Clay website, start an account myself and do everything and then buy the product if I want to use it further, and not like talking to the team and then having a sales process before I can use it.
I think the hardest thing about that is that it takes a long time to find the right kind of flywheel to drive that motion, right? So in our case, it's agencies who are, or like where we started it was agencies who wanted to find business for themselves and found Clay to be super helpful for them. And they were talking about it and posting about it and telling their friends. And then more people hearing about that and trying Clay, right? So you need it to experiment quite a bit and to have a thesis that makes sense around that. And then you need to be very, very fast at fixing all of the little paper cuts, because it can be, you know, there are so many. It was kind of interesting because in the beginning, every time we removed a little roadblock from, you know, the path of like getting started on Clay or paying, we would see huge jumps in the number of people that were using it. So even seemingly small things that we'd be like, well, if someone really wants it, they'll get over this. They don't. They just drop off. And so you have to be very careful that you make the path of success like clear. And at the same time, you have to balance that out with not lying to yourself that you actually have like true product market fit and a PLG movement, and that you don't keep doing things to smooth out the path when there really is no pull. So really being, it is an art to know, oh, this is the pull, right? People are coming to the product and they really want to use it despite the hurdles. And then you start to remove the hurdles, and then you see, as you remove a hurdle, you see a big jump, right? So having the patience for that, and then having the ability to hold on to the belief that it will work, even though it's taking time. And then at the same time, being super honest with yourself about what isn't working and why you need to fix it. So holding all of these things that are conflicting together is very challenging, right? And I think what's helpful there is if you have clarity around why you believe it's going to work, and then managing your emotions so that you don't freak out when it doesn't work, and that you also don't change your mind too often while you're running an experiment, right? You need to like have the patience to wait to see, does it pan out or not? And if it doesn't pan out, make the change, wait again. So I do think it's actually a big part of it is a form of patience and being able to handle failing, especially failing like publicly and not having like shame about that.
I would love to ask follow-up questions, but I need to hold myself short. For everyone who hasn't tested Clay yet, quick opportunity for you. What would be the easiest use case that can give me a wow moment when I now click on a link in the show notes and say, I'll test Clay for the first time?
You should go to clay.com. You can enter, for example, a bunch of companies that you're interested in, and then you can use our Use AI integration to ask any question about the company. So you can say something like, does it have SOC 2 compliance, which is a type of security compliance? You can ask, what technologies does it use and how much do they spend on some of these technologies? And we'll go out and figure out how to get you that info.
Cool. Kareem, lots of things that we covered today. Thank you so much for sharing all these thoughts, experiences, learnings. It's been such a pleasure. I can imagine I'll write to you at some point with a different idea on a different topic to double click on. But for now, for today, we will call it a day, and I'll link to your LinkedIn, but also to Clay in the show notes. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, I really appreciate the time, and hopefully this was helpful.
It definitely was. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Kareem from Clay and giving insights into the journey of the struggling part and the struggling phase of 5 years before there is the uptick, before there is the momentum. So as I can imagine that it's way more people listening right now that are struggling too than having like everything working perfectly fine. I hear you. We hear you. All the founders hear you. So therefore, thanks for listening and staying till the end. But also, if you found this episode helpful, please share it with a friend. I can imagine that somebody needs to hear the Clay story to say, hey, I'm sticking to this project and I want to continue. So please share it with a friend or share it on socials if you really enjoyed. We can also share you and send you some video snippets in high edit quality. You can just email us at fabian@unicornbakery.de. And if you haven't already, feel free to subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcast so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes with like the former CRO of Cloudflare, who built Cloudflare into a $1 billion ARR engine, Stelly FD from Close.com, another episode with Mark from Strava, and many, many more. So you would miss a lot if you don't follow to the Unicorn Bakery now. Thanks for listening. It's been such a pleasure, and see you next week.